Pushing Faders in association with SVG Europe Audio.
Hello and welcome to Pushing Faders, the podcast where we talk about broadcast sound. I'm Chris Eckford, and first things first, is it too late to say Happy New Year? That's verging on Partridge-esque, I think, there. But yeah, it's near the end of January. Happy New Year, and hope everybody had a good Christmas. It seems like ages since I had a show out, which was the middle of December, and if you listen to the Strictly show, then Richard and Andy were right with their guesses as to who would win it. I just really would like to know who won the sweepstake. I really ought to ask them, you know. So yeah, moving on from that, just like to say again a massive thank you to everybody who's listened to the podcast so far. Everybody's got back in touch with me to say like that they've been enjoying it, the feedback's been really good, and I had quite a nice long chat in a drizzly car park at Tottenham with a camera operator about the show, so that was quite nice as well. And I have got some more shows already lined up. I've got three or four in the can, and as they say, and a couple more prepped and ready to go with people to record with. So without any more of me going on and on, this week's guest is Lynn Munro, who is the centre court sound supervisor at Wimbledon, amongst other things that she does. And just a massive thanks to Lynn for being the first guest of this year, and hope you all enjoy it. Hi Lynn, and thanks for joining me on the podcast. If you could just start things off by telling us how your career in TV began.
I don't know. I think like a lot of sound engineers, I was a really music obsessed teenager and really into all that side of it. Loved going to gigs and stuff. And I think originally I wanted to be a roadie actually. And then right. I kind of noticed that they were all men. And do you know what I also loved? And this is a bit cheesy, but I used to also love shows like It'll Be All Right on the Night. Do you remember those kind of things that used to be kind of TV funnies and all that kind of stuff? And then I can remember doing a little bit of work experience at theatres and things. I just absolutely loved it. And then I did electronics and music at uni. And when I was graduating, just by some kind of stroke of luck, the BBC were taking on audio trainees. And right. I thought, oh, no, I really want to do this. And so I ended up going as an audio trainee to the BBC in Birmingham, but it was called Pebble Mill then. Yeah. So, and it was actually a really, really great place to start because it was one of the few places where you were allowed to do radio and TV in studios and radio bees. So you kind of got to be part of an audio unit that, that kind of gave you a really good look around everything. Mm. So, yeah, I was extremely lucky and I absolutely loved that job. So, yeah. Oh, good. And then I stayed there for about 4 years and I absolutely loved OBs, actually. That was the thing that I really took to. I really enjoyed the kind of build process, you know. I absolutely loved that. I always found the kind of problem-solving aspect of it really, really fun and really rewarding as well, actually. And so a job came up at O2-1 TV in Birmingham, so I joined them and that was great. That was really great.
I guess if you had the early inclinations of wanting to be a roadie, then like OBs is the roadie version of working TV.
Yeah, totally. Lugging stuff around.
Yeah.
So I was at O2-1 for quite a long time and working as a guarantee engineer, but O2-1 was a little bit different in that we also got to mix and, in some companies, a lot of the guarantee engineers don't get to mix. So, really lucky in that respect. And I don't know if you were ever lucky enough to come across John Clements in your life in sound, but he was head of sound at O2-1 and he was absolutely brilliant for me. He was such a good teacher and he really pushed me. He really kind of, kind of trusted you just to get on with it. And you had to get on with it. You know, it was a really busy company and you just had to be getting on with it pretty much from day one, really. So, yeah, it was a lot of fun.
What year did you start at your O2-1?
I started at O2-1 in 99.
Right.
So, yeah, and then I went freelance, I think, in 2009. Mm. So, yeah, so I did 10 years of working there. And it was really good. You had to kind of, it was pretty much your life actually, because you pretty much had to be prepared to drop everything and just go, the next morning to wherever
I
at
think
zero notice.
it's like that's the joy of working for an OB company, isn't it? That you sort of
Absolutely.
you're at their beck and call most of the year.
And that can be difficult, obviously, at different points in your life. That can be very difficult, but it also, you're kind of in the thick of it at that point too. And I loved being part of, being able to see jobs through from their very start to their very finish, and being responsible for them. I think that's something you miss a little bit when you're freelance. So,
So you went freelance in 2009. Was that to pursue more of a supervisor role, or was that to guarantee as well?
Well, do you know what? So Gravity Media bought Auto1, and in the kind of last few years that I was at Auto1, I was doing more and more work for them, where I was being pulled away from truck jobs in the UK to go and do jobs overseas, flyaway type jobs for them. Actually, quite a lot on the tennis tour, on the ATP tour. And I absolutely loved that work. I loved the whole kind of, you get all your stuff turns up in a flight case, like, if you're lucky, sometimes it doesn't. And then you've just got to get on with it, haven't you? You've just got to make it work. And so I was doing more and more work for them. I also really, really enjoyed the travel, actually. And one of their productions, we can give you as much work as you want, blah, blah, blah. And in the end, I did. So there you go. So,
It's just, it is always a temptation when you sort of get that carrot dangled about all the work, then you think, yeah, it's about time I did that. So was
I
that
think it
set up
was the right thing.
everything as a guarantee then, or was the ATP thing more of you did everything on the job?
Yeah, I did a bit of everything. So I did do a bit of guaranteeing, like kind of in the, you'd set up a kind of MCR, and but I also did mixing courts and stuff. So anyway, that was where I started out doing tennis, and I probably did 3 or 4 years on the ATP tour, kind of on and off it, in various roles. And it was great because, with regard to tennis mixing, you got a chance to have a bit of a fiddle, really. There was plenty of time to experiment and see what worked and what didn't, and see what you thought sounded good. And but yeah, so it was a lot of fun, really.
And
Hard work, but a lot of fun.
is that what sort of led you on to the Wimbledon stuff then?
Yeah, I think so. I think so. I mean, I've kind of done worked in Wimbledon, I think, for 12 years or so. So is that right? Yeah, it must be about 12 years. And so started off at court two, and then court one, and then centre court, and all good.
Is that just a progression, as in once somebody stops doing that,
Yeah,
then
pretty much. They're my shoes.
it's the case it seems the case with jobs like that, where it's like one person sort of retires and it's like, right, who's the next one but move
And
them
there's a
up.
reshuffle. I was pretty much like
I was sort of trying to picture Wimbledon, because I've never worked on it before. It's one of those things, ever since I went freelance, I've ended up on like football tournaments in the summer, so I've had a few like, can you do Wimbledon, but I've never been able to fit it in. But I get the impression it's a little bit like the Open, where it's like a huge operation that, it's every year, but it's like, unlike a lot of big events where it's like every 4 years or 2 years or whatever, that's like a huge event that rolls in and every in and out every year, where I think the prep seems to go on for about a month before, from what I can tell
Oh
from
no, yeah, at
guarantees.
least I think more like 6 weeks or so. Yeah, I mean, it's a huge OB. There's no doubt about that. I mean, I think they cover, I think it's 18 courts
Yes,
that
it
are
is.
covered.
I'd literally just Googled that before we
Did
came.
you? Oh,
And it was I saw it. It was on a. It was a quiz question on a TV show. How many courts do they have at Wimbledon? And I couldn't remember the answer, so I thought I'd better Google it. But yeah, it's 18 courts during the tournament, which is massive, really. And that's, obviously, that gets whittled down, I guess, as the tournament goes on, to two or three by the end of it.
But there's also, I mean, there's kind of huge amounts of stand-up areas, press conferences, all kinds of beauty cameras, all with related feeds. You know, it's I imagine it is. I haven't worked on the Open, but I imagine it is a similar thing. And it's quite it's a really good OB to work on, and obviously the world and his wife is there, so it's quite a sociable OB as well. Yeah. And it's great. And but it's interesting. I've always really enjoyed it actually. Mm. So,
and from saying before about being able to experiment, has it been sort of a basic setup for the last however many years, and then you've just been able to supplement it when? Because is it 5.1 now?
Yeah, it's 5.1. So it's been 5.1 for a while.
Yeah.
And I think it's UHD HDR. I think that was the last, because it's one of these events that, you can kind of say, okay, it's the same every year, but actually things are being kind of tweaked and progressing year on year. I think, Sam Broadfoot from NEP, who's in charge of it kind of technically, is working alongside WBS, who have Paul Davis and James Muir, I think, is their head of broadcast. And so I think there's every year there's like something new, like a little kind of step forward, and so last year I think Centre Court and Court One were UHD HDR, and obviously there's all these kind of trace court coverage and stuff that goes on now as well, so it's always quite interesting to see what the latest thing is, the kind of next step. And the coverage of it did change a bit when it moved, because I think I worked in the last couple of years being the BBC or Sisselby's that were doing it. So it did change when NEP took over. And, obviously, because they've got their own way that they want to do it. And, it's been very successful.
I was I was talking to Nev Hooper for the podcast. It's not come out yet, but he was saying that one of the big things they brought in that he thinks was a good improvement was ident in every feed, so every feed's got its own name to it, so when somebody comes to take it on the morning, they can see that that is the correct feed, rather than there being any sort of like concern that's just bars and tone for the morning. And I think making a lot of it IPs actually helped with that.
Yeah for sure. I mean, obviously, I just sit down and mix, and all the clever stuff is done by loads of NEP engineers who kind of live underground at Wimbledon. There's the kind of whole underground kind of broadcast center, but Nev's obviously kind of oversees a lot of that. And I think I think there's a few things about tennis coverage I think that make it a little bit different. I mean, just things like, your feed needs to be pretty much clean from the moment you start until the moment you finish. So, the rig has to be rock solid, really, because really one lot are going off the course, the next lot are coming on. You literally might have, if you're lucky, a minute to sort something. And if not, you've got to kind of find a way to squirrel that out. But I'm sure that you feel this way too in what you do, that we have to acknowledge that any sound coverage is a huge team effort, isn't it? And the coverage itself is only as good as everybody's efforts, the guarantee and the engineers that are out in the field. And we only have two engineers out in the field at Wimbledon. It's pretty minimal. Yeah, so you've got one person on the court. So Graeme Jacobs looks after the court, and he's done it for years actually. And it's really important that he's established really good relationships, with the kind of officials, with WBS, with the BBC floor managers, with the grounds people, because hopefully, they're the people that you need to call on in an emergency. And, and also Alan Gomez does commentary, and the commentary area at Wimbledon is minute. It's really, really tight. And we've obviously got a lot of fibre racks and stuff in there. And, he's got a lot of very big personalities to deal with in a very small space. And so it just takes a bit of, there's always that kind of bit of a manoeuvring really going on. And so I think that I don't know, maybe more so than some other things. It's important to have these good relationships with the sound engineers out in the field have with all the people around them, really.
Yeah, especially like if it's rolling on and off court, you do need somebody who's, from your point of view, is almost floor managing it from your point of view, where they can tell you, right, they're coming straight back out, to get on, this interview's coming in.
Yeah, very much so, very much so.
With it being the court coverage, are you sort of, do you have the luxury of that is predominantly like 80% of what you do for your mix? It's not, obviously, do you have like lots of extra bits going on, like world feed interviews and?
Well, what we do is, so we have the court coverage, and the commentary is ours as well, and the on-court interviews afterwards. So the interviews in, prior to the pandemic, the interviews used to be done in an interview room off the court. And then because of the pandemic, these interview rooms were literally like 2 meters by 2 meters. Yeah. So, and because of the pandemic, you couldn't squeeze everybody that you needed to into that space. And so they started doing them out on the court. And, that's been a kind of real improvement, because I think the crowd really enjoy that, really enjoy hearing it. And also, I think it kind of, it manages a little bit what the reporters are able to ask. And it tends to be much more of a kind of celebration rather than asking somebody about what they're wearing or,
It does bring in the more human feel of the players, I guess, if they've got like the crowd that they've got to react to rather than just, just a reporter standing in a dead room with them.
Yeah. And the atmosphere on Centre Court, it's really great. And one of the things that struck me when I went to the court, first of all, is that it's actually quite a small space. It's really tight, particularly at the kind of service lines. And so the crowd are on top of the players. And, that all kind of lends towards it being this kind of, when a huge cheer goes off, it's really amazing. It's really, sounds great. So,
So from a technical point of view, then what's the set up around the court from your point of view?
We have we have mics on the service lines. So in the last couple of years, we've managed to change the club, WBS, are very particular about the aesthetic of Wimbledon. So that's something that we have to kind of compromise on. You can't really put your mics exactly where you want to put your mics. And quite often you can't have the mics that you exactly want to have either. So in the past, what they've had are M&S's on either end, and they kind of end up looking like a little ball covered in a green rye coat. And I think it's normally like a hypercardioid kind of, is it an 80-50, I think it might be, an 80-50. And then Ambient make those little figure of eight mics that go in, that can make any gun mic into an M&S. And then I think it might be a 208, right, possibly, might be wrong with that, but so they've used those because they can fit them into a nice little neat ball. And I was really keen for us to actually get rid of those and use 4 and 6s if possible, just 2 8s end. And the club thankfully changed the way that the players come onto court and centre court, and it's now a gate that opens from the far end in the middle of the screen. So of course that was absolutely brilliant for me, because it meant that we couldn't mount the M&S in the centre anymore. So therefore we got to have our 4 and 6s at the far end. And unfortunately at the near end, it was still an M&S last year because we didn't have any way of mounting the 4 and 6s where we wanted to put them. But this year we're hoping that we can make that change. And I think that the M&S's, aesthetically, they were perfect. They were what the club wanted to see. But I think that for us, what we had on the desk, Chris, as well, you'd have the M&S and then you'd break the M out again so that you could push that a little bit more for your serve. But then what I also found is that you kind of needed to lose it, or otherwise the return would often come back pretty wide and that would not be reflected in the sound at all. If you don't get rid of that M, you've just got far too much M in it and not enough S. And you'd see the players like diving out to the side, and it just wouldn't actually be reflected in how it sounded.
Yes, it was monoed up slightly.
Yeah, exactly. And it was hard to get the width that you wanted in the stereo, really. And kind of another feeling that I had too is that, so these are mounted fairly high up and the crowd is just a couple of feet off them, really. Mm. And so when you're trying to push that S to give you a wider stereo, you're just getting a lot more crowd on them as well, you know, a lot more crowd. And I think with the 416s, with what we've been able to do with them, just we're not allowed to put them on the surface of the court. The club won't let us do that. And so, but just the kind of little bit of rejection that you get off the back of them, I think really, really helps you, because it's really hard to be able to get any differentiation between your court effects and your crowd with the way that the court is, you know. So I think that that's been really helpful. Mm. And so hopefully this year, we're going to have 4416s with a bit of luck this year. It's like fairly standard. But you know what? I actually don't think in tennis that it helps to have too many mics open.
Yeah.
I think you end up with a wash of noise. So I think less is more. Mm. And I think your mic placement is really important, because it's super dynamic tennis. Mm. And I think that you want to be able to let that happen. You really want the sound to kind of convey the kind of emotion and the drama of the event.
Yeah.
And I think the Wimbledon as well, it's kind of maybe got, a little bit of a genteel kind of strawberries and cream type image. But I think that when you're talking about the play, I think it's really important that you're conveying that this is an epic sporting event, that they are out to win, and there's nothing genteel about it.
I guess what you said about the dynamic range between, there's a lot of silence.
Yeah.
It was funny. I've not mixed tennis, but I did the Queen's Club Prez for Eurosport years ago, and it was the first year they brought out, or one of the first year or so, when R128 came out. So one of the MCR operators was keying through saying, oh, you're really quiet, you need to get your... I was like, well, there's nothing else. What do you want me to do? Like, put tone out when there's nothing going on?
But I think the worst thing you can do is actually mess with that too much. But that's where I think that the placement of your microphones is so important, because if you get your 416s on your service lines bang on access, then you can actually hear that ball being bounced. It's absolute silence, but you can just hear that ball being bounced. And then, of course, you can have the off the scale loud cheering. But that's where we're so fortunate, with the quality of gear that we're using, because, with 416s, with a Calric Apollo, I'm cool with sitting with some red lights on the desk. That is absolutely fine. But I think, you've just got to kind of put the luffs to one side, really, and not worry about it too much.
I think it was, with it being the first year that they it was sort of being implemented, I think somebody was being a little bit overly protective of them.
I remember those days.
Yeah. It's funny what you're saying about the back rejection from a 416, because DPA have brought out a competitor to the 416 that offers even more. I think the information I got from them was they're targeting boxing, for like boom poles and things. It'd be quite interesting for like that kind of thing, where you want a more directional, pointing at the lines and stuff, to see how it would work with something like that.
Definitely, because I think so too, that as I'm sure from the stuff that you do, you're trying to keep a kind of reasonably even surround crowd noise. And so when you end up with that, with so little rejection from your court mics and so much crowd on your court mics, it just tips all of that out of whack a bit, doesn't it? And it's very hard then to keep it as a kind of...
Well, that's the thing. I'm obviously mixing football quite a lot. I hate looking at the front left and right and seeing that it's pretty mono from the ball kicks. I'd rather sort of hold the ball kicks back and let the crowd be there, rather than, have the front left and right look like this.
Yeah, totally. Because at that point, it doesn't sound real, does it? You know,
I think also you're getting rid of the point of having, you know, a 5-1 setup. When you make it to mono.
Yeah.
What do you use to build your 5-1? Is it a sound field or do you put an array out?
Yeah, we've normally got two sound field arrays up in the roof. And I mean, they're up in the roof and they're fairly inaccessible and they're pretty much not accessible at all once the crowd are in. So that's why we've got two arrays up there so that we can hopefully, you know, conjure something if one of them falls over.
Is that one each end or is that just...
No, they're both in the same position. So they tend to be kind of like... top left with respect to camera one. So and you know what, that's purely because that's where we can rig them. It's one of those limitations really. So but you know, it does tend to work pretty well.
It's one of those, nobody knows where you've rigged it when you're watching it back at home, do they? So
exactly. And I think so other stuff that we have around the court, we tend to put an ECM, you know, any old ECM will do, into the neck cord at one side. And that's, you know, it's not got much gain in it, maybe like, you know, 24 dBs. And it's more of a, it's just getting that kind of contact as it hits the net or whatever. Mm. And then we have some more 416s on the umpire's chair, a pair kind of looking into the court, which we call the argue mics, which are kind of for if your player kind of steps forward to have a good old argument with the umpire, hopefully you can get them on those. But they can also help you out a little bit with a bit of, you know, kind of near the net type play.
Yeah.
And then we have what we call the snoop mics, which are looking onto the chairs that the players are sitting on, which get, you know, if they're talking to the umpire there and, you know, and all that kind of stuff. But I'm just trying to think what else we have. We have 2 816s mounted on cameras that are on Sheffield plates to the left of the court. And I don't tend to sit with lots of them in the mix, but if I think they're really useful for if you ever feel, because I like to keep it quite tight, actually, the mix. And then I think that if you ever feel like it's a little bit too tight, if you kind of just edge in a little bit of those, it just seems to just open it up a degree for you without really having to change any of the rest of the your gain settings, your compression that you've got set up. And I do think that the tennis mixing is definitely one of those things where you can really use, you know, the headroom of the desk to help you, you know, to help you kind of achieve what you're wanting to achieve. And I also really think that once you've got your mix set, you don't want to be touching it that much. Just let it roll, let it roll. Because you can hear those fades as well.
Yeah. You know, I guess it's such a dynamic range between the play but bouncing the ball and no play really, and then, you know, the crowd going absolutely mental because there's been a rally or whatever. It, from a sporting point of view, it must be quite, or a mixing point of view, it must be quite one of the sports to have the biggest dynamic range between the quiet moments and the loudest moments.
I think so. And that's also where, you know, your commentators come into it, because when you've got good commentators, they obviously raise their voices.
Yeah.
You know, when you need them to, and have a kind of broadcastable whisper level. Sometimes you know, Sally, you meet kind of, you know, inexperienced commentators and their whisper is actually a whisper. I get that when you're in that comm box and you're right at the feet of the players, you probably do feel like you need to whisper, but it's not helpful, is it?
No.
Not helpful. So
is that the commentary that you put on there, is that like the World Feed one or is that the BBC, do you put the BBC one on?
Well, it is the World Feed one and it is also the BBC one. So it's what the BBC use and it is what goes out on the World Feed.
It's produced by, the production of it is Wimbledon themselves now, isn't it?
That's right, Wimbledon Broadcast Services. So that's been the case for a few years now.
I remember when that happened, it was, because the BBC obviously did it for years, didn't they? And then
they went
to them. Was it to do with the ECM? Is that literally just for the clipping the
For clipping. So literally all you're getting, it's more of a contact really than any kind of audio in particular that you're getting. So you're just getting that as it whips into the net or as it whips across the net or Mm-hmm.
They're quite nice mics, yeah. Like that.
Because actually, you'd be surprised. Sometimes without it, you don't hear it. Yeah. You don't hear it at all. So, and then obviously, we take the Ampara's mic, and we tend to wrap our own ECM around RG Jones's mics, so we've got that as a bit of a backup. Mm. And
is there anything you'd like to change and experiment with next year?
I managed to convince the club to allow us to move the mics on the umpire's chair from the back of the chair to the front of the chair. And you'd be surprised how big a deal that was. Mm. But also just how helpful it is, like literally bringing them a meter forward. And that was last year. So that was really helpful. That was great. I think I was fairly happy with how it was last year. Mm. Like I say, I think this year they moved to the 416s on the near side. Will mean that you know, we can pretty much leave that balance kind of up and running and good. It all seems to work pretty well. We do interviews on court, as I was saying. So the stick mics are provided by RG Jones, and then, you know, we take our feeds from them. Mm. And you know, there's a few hangover mics that you still kind of get. You know, there's one, I think, which is reserved for Cliff Richard. You never appear. I'd want to, have a song.
Oh, God.
So,
imagine that. Yeah. That's. I mean, I think it's a pretty regular occurrence now. And it's been most years he likes to pop up and do something.
Yes.
What do you have to keep you occupied during a rain delay? Do you do anything in particular?
Well, do you know what? The rain delays are pretty much a thing of the past when it comes to Centre Court and Court One because of the roofs.
Yeah,
and,
true.
Do you know, first of all, it used to take a while for the roof to shut, and then last year it took about 10 minutes. So we were quite often caught out a bit because you'd kind of nip out to get a coffee or something, and then it's like, oh my God, we're back on. But it happens pretty quickly. But the roof is an interesting.
Does it change the dynamic much from your mix point?
Yeah, massively, massively. So we've got a DNS live that we do. The thing is, too, is that you have to hopefully get a moment with the roof closed where you can do a learn on it, have a listen to where you think that is, make any adjustments you want to make. Because really, once you're on, you don't have that opportunity. Mm. Because your coverage has to be always good, so you can't suddenly suck a load of stuff out of the mix without anybody noticing. So, and then what you tend to do is, as they're crossing the roof, just wind that in slowly in the hope that nobody notices. Yeah. And I think it just helps kind of cut down the reverberation in there. It can gets a bit reverberant. And you know, we've had some nights that, if I'm really honest, it sounded pretty awful because there's just been such insane amounts of rain on the roof. And I think at that point, about the only thing you can do is just lose as much of the effects from the mix as you can get away with. There's just no point in pushing that. I mean, it sounds like white noise, really, at that point. Or certainly, you know, take your crowd out as much as you can get away with, and then you're pretty much dependent on the court mics. And at that point, the 5-1 has suffered, but it's that or this horrendous racket, really.
Yeah, you almost want a low 5-1 at that, a low sound field at that point, don't you? Just to sort of think, right, I've got this out.
I mean, we literally have nowhere to put it because we have thought about, you know, have we got any other alternatives? And the answer, sadly, is no. Really, with being able to get something, because ideally, if you could have something just hanging over the crowd but not tucked up near the roof, that would be amazing. But we've yet to solve that puzzle.
I imagine it's all like committee meetings and, you know, to make one change from a
And I mean, I do understand that it's important to the club. It's, you know, I think Wimbledon prides itself on that aesthetic, doesn't it? And, you know, obviously you've got to be clear of any advertising, as you will have experienced a lot with the footy, and all of that kind of stuff is important. So, and it also it's important, you know, in terms of the players, like, you know, you can't you can't cause anybody to have to do a detour around one of your mics. That's
no.
You know, not allowed. So
no, you,
so yeah,
it's one of those the perils of putting mics out into is whether someone's going to clatter into it for you.
Yeah, absolutely. Because, you know, if I was in an ideal world, I would like to have the Court 416s on those stands. Mm. But, you know, at that point, you can get away with that a lot of the time. But you are also then, you know, a little bit at the mercy of the feet of the line judges. Yeah. And, you know, and on the ATP tour, I've seen like one of the players give them like a good old kicking. Like,
yeah, I love the football. Good, oh, good few times.
Frustration. You know, so you're kind of a little bit at the mercy of that, really. Mm. So... Yeah, yeah.
It's hard.
I mean, you know,
I was going to say it's hard. Sorry, it's hard. It's hard when you work on a sport where it's, you know, so aesthetically perfect to want to be able to make changes.
Yeah. I mean, we're pretty limited. But that the discussion of whether we could conjure another 5.1 array somewhere away from the roof was. You know, that was something that I thought that we really could do with giving consideration to, but it's been cited as being pretty much impossible because there's just nowhere to rig it from. Mm. You know, there's nowhere to rig it from. So, so yeah.
It's a shame that when, because I think having the roof, I mean, it must make it a lot louder from the crowd as well when they start.
Yeah, it's incredibly loud. It's incredibly loud. Mm. It does change the mix completely. But it's interesting because it's that thing too, isn't it? You don't often read comments where people have complained about the effects being too quiet.
No.
It's normally the other way around. Yeah. So if you're ever reading criticisms of the coverage of a sporting event, it tends to be that the effects are too loud and they can't hear the commentary. So I think that when the effects just turn into some kind of horrendous white noise, it's just, you've got to cut your losses at that point and just make sure that the, you know, what else you can get out of it.
It's funny as well, because obviously you're saying it's just quite a small space. If you think about like the Millennium Stadium, I've worked there when it's had the roof open and closed. And I don't think it really makes it louder when the roof's closed, but you can't hear what's going on outside. Whereas that's quite a tight space where you put a roof on it and it, you know, it sounds like you're in a tent.
Yeah, the Millennium Stadium, yeah. I've already done that as well when the roof's closed. It's quite interesting, isn't it? It's quite
especially when it's like, you know, roaring Welsh fans are, you know, creating.
Yeah,
absolutely.
It's crazy. Incredibly loud.
It felt like everything was a lot more tight and closed in when the roof was closed. Mm-hmm. But then when it was open, the roof up being open sort of made it feel less imposing from a crowd point of view.
Yeah, for sure.
I suppose you don't get that with tennis. You don't have particularly raucous fans, do you? I suppose.
Not raucous, I would say, but still enthusiastic. Yeah. So, you know, like a cheer from centre court. But you know, as I was saying earlier, like I'm definitely very keen to just let that dynamic range go. Yeah. You know.
Oh, definitely. It's
just let the whole thing take off a bit. You know, you want to kind of. Yeah, I don't know. I think it's really important to use sound as a, you know, a vehicle to show the emotion of the event. You know, we can really make a difference in that respect. There's nothing worse than a really flat sound mix.
Yeah. I think that's one of the things from when I do football is having noticeable difference between when the crowd's not into it and when the crowd's going nuts. Like, and it's the same with that. The difference with tennis, I guess, is the crowd's politely quiet, and then when something happens, that's when they start, and that's the emotion there, is it, where you've got the tension of no crowd noise and then a sudden burst of it.
Yeah, for sure. But I think it's you know, kind of as I was saying earlier, I really like to get to that point where you're just not really mixing all that much. You're barely moving it.
Yeah.
You're just letting, you know, if you get your gain settings right and your compression settings right, you're just letting it go, really. And then really you're just kind of, you know, paying attention to what your commentators are doing and where they're sitting, really. And you know, and kind of like we say as well, this is a collaboration. So you know that it's really important too to take on board kind of any feedback from rights holders, you know, from the BBC, from ESPN. And I think if, you know, can't be too pig-headed about these things. If people are not happy with it, you've got to be like, okay, well, let's make a change. Let's see what we can do.
Do you get many people sticking their nose in saying, oh, you should just do this a little bit different?
No, not too many, actually. No. I was surprised. I thought there'd be a lot more. No, not too bad. Not too bad. And you know, depending on who it is, obviously there's some people that I'm more than happy to hear their opinion and take their opinion on board. And then there's, you know, without wanting to be rude, if there's other people who you know don't mix really much, then I'm afraid I just kind of smile and nod. Smile and nod and let it go.
Definitely. Yeah. I mean, is it 12 years you've been doing the ATP stuff now and all that?
I think I did about 40. So,
what other stuff do you work on?
Kind of like yourself, you know, a lot of sport, just the bread and butter, isn't it? Yeah. Of OBs, so
it's coming from the life of OBs, and you sort of gravitate to sport. I think that's the
and I do enjoy it actually. Do you know what, I've never really enjoyed doing too much of one thing, so I like to kind of remain a little bit, you know, more in the mix. So a little bit, you know, a bit of rugby, a bit of football. Do the horse racing for ITV, which really enjoy. Just did the Rugby World Cup for ITV, which was really good fun. And but we, you know, we did it mostly remotely actually, and we just went out for the quarterfinal. I do the proms, which I absolutely love. And you know, there's the kind of various award shows, chat shows, it's kind of. All that kind of stuff, funerals, weddings.
Yes, there's been quite a lot of them this last 2 years as well.
Yeah, games me and plus.
Do you still enjoy being on the road?
Do you know, I love it. Yeah. I mean, you know, I had my son was born in 2011, and so I had to at that point. I went literally from being hardly ever in the UK to trying to change work to being just in London so I could be home as much as possible. And so that's kind of been, you know, and now as well, I'm a single parent. And so it's kind of, you know, it's more important that, you know, I can go and do some work and come back. But now that he's a bit older, I do go away a little bit now, not as much, anything like as much as I used to. And I do still absolutely love it. I mean, doing the quarterfinals of the Rugby World Cup in Marseille, and you know, you just have a good rig day, and then we were down in the port to Marseille having a lovely meal and a beer, and you just kind of think, what's not to like about this job?
Definitely.
You know, what's not to like about this?
It's days like that that make up for the, you know, snowy days in places like Stoke and whatnot. It's interesting when sort of, you know, you're saying about wanting to be a roadie. It, like I said earlier, it does give you that feel that working in TV is the, especially in OBs, is the roadie life of the TV world.
And yeah, absolutely. I think it scratches that itch, doesn't it? So,
and I think people who work on the road just love doing it. Whereas, like, you know, especially like you speak to a lot of people who just work in studios and like, oh, I couldn't do what you do, you know, in late nights. It's like, yeah, but that's the part of the enjoyment of it.
That's the buzz of it. Absolutely. That's the buzz of it. And I think too, I don't know how you feel, Chris. I mean, I know that you've done time at Sky and everything, but I struggle a little bit now to be in the same place for very long.
Yeah.
You know.
I always feel there's no element of danger when you're working in somewhere that's been set up for quite a while.
Yeah, totally, because TV studios just tend to work, don't they? They just tend to work. And so, you know, you haven't got the... And for me, you know, the joy of the job sometimes is overcoming these problems, you know? And the kind of buzz you get from being able to make something work and being able to get on air when you know, it felt like the universe was against you, you know.
So, I think we've all been there as well. When you, the other days I was talking to the guys from Strictly, I said that the stories that everybody prefers are the ones where it's not been going very well and you suddenly get on air and it all happens.
Yeah, the overcoming of adversity, I think, is you know, something that we all
It's definitely what makes going working in a studio for a few weeks seem a bit sterile.
I think you're right. Yeah. A little bit dull. I don't know if we're fools, but yeah, a bit dull. But yeah, no, I love it. I have to say, sorry, carry on, Chris.
I said I much prefer the danger of being on the road.
Yeah, me too. Yeah. I think it's more. It's for me. It's a lot to do with the pleasure that you get when you leave at the end of the day. Yeah. I think that it's much greater on OBs for me. And I love being on site. I just really thoroughly enjoy it. Mm. You know,
it's got a lot more of a fun, like, you know, everybody that does it, it has, you know, you tend to have more of a laugh, I think.
Definitely, everybody's invested in it as well, aren't they? You know.
So the last question I always ask people that have worked on the road for some years is, do you have a favourite service station?
Oh, well, I used to, when I lived in Birmingham, used to be going a lot from London to Birmingham, driving back and forth all the time. And my eyes used to always shut just before Warwick services. Right. So although it's not my favourite services, because I think everybody would go for, you know, the tea bay services possibly with all the nice food.
But
Warwick services used to have to pull in and get coffee.
Yeah, but that's most frequented.
Their most regular customer.
Yeah, I feel that with Newport Pagnell. That's my most frequented one these days. But not my favourite. It's not very good at all. But thank you very much for joining me on this show. It's been nice to have a chat with you. I think I always like after... think back to if I've worked with people, and I feel I've done a BT Sport Europa League game with you.
I think I've done a couple of footballs with you. I think where you've been match mixing.
Yeah,
and I've been
West Ham, I think.
Impressed. Yeah, I tend to try to only go as far as London when it comes to football, I'm afraid.
No, it's my same with, I tend to try and stay within an hour of the house with the football, but yeah, it doesn't always work out like that.
You know, it doesn't, but no, I'm pretty strict now with football. I'm afraid that I pretty much only take ones that are local, but it's fine.
Well, thank you very much for talking to me today. It's been great.
Okay, thanks, Chris.
A massive thanks to Lynn for giving up her time to talk to me on the podcast. Thank you very much, Lynn. Wimbledon and tennis in general is something I've never mixed before, so it was quite nice to get a bit of a peek behind the curtain as to how it's done, especially on a big event like that. So that's it for this week's episode, but don't fret, because I know I can hear you all panicking. In 2 weeks' time, there's going to be another episode out. This one will feature Nev Hooper from NEP. It's actually a conversation I had with him recorded back in early December, but we're only just going to get released in a couple of weeks' time. So until then... have a good couple of weeks and might see people in a car park by the bins and all that kind of thing.